You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode number 181 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
You're going for spooky now?
Yeah, of course. It's the Halloween edition of the Pelton Cast.
It is the Halloween edition of the Pelton Cast. We're coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 Seattle Seahawks, whose second half schedule is more trick than treat. Preview of what's to come. But first off, from the top, we got to start off by toasting, because this is not technically an emergency pod. We were scheduled to record anyway, but it is a celebratory pod tonight as your Seattle Sounders FC, for the third time in the last 4 years, are headed to the MLS Cup Final, bringing down the greatest team in MLS regular season history, LAFC, 3-1 in their house tonight. How about it? We need to toast to it. What
right,
are we
well,
toasting with?
Let's talk
with?
About what we are toasting with here, because I've got some thoughts.
Okay.
So I have here in front of me, we know who does it better than anybody who's ever done it. Pumpkin beer. And that is our good friends at Elysian Brewing.
Yeah, but Budweiser also knew that, and they were alluded to that in their Super Bowl commercial a few years ago.
They don't make pumpkin beer. Elysian makes pumpkin beer.
But they had just recently purchased Elysian.
This is amusing. The Elysian Brewing Pumpkin Pack. Four different pumpkin beers from Elysian Brewing. Let me just read through what we've got here. They've honestly scaled it back. Let me just say, I think they heard our feedback from a few years ago. They said, you know what? We have we're up to like 20 different pumpkin beers.
I'm not questioning whether that was our feedback. I'm questioning whether they've actually scaled it back or
you
whether
can go
it's
look
just
it up. No,
in
they
this
don't.
Pack.
They don't make that many pumpkin beers anymore.
Huh. Okay.
But
they found their best ones. They found their strengths and stuck to them.
What we have here in front of us and we'll be enjoying tonight is four different pumpkin and fall seasonal beers from our good friends at Elysian Brewing Company. First off, we have the Great Pumpkin. Inspired by
it's the Great Pumpkin Charlie Brown.
That's it. Imperial Pumpkin.
I didn't know if
ale.
That was rhetorical or if you wanted me the to actually
great,
fill that in.
No, I liked it. The Great Pumpkin is the world's first Imperial Pumpkin Ale. It's fact checking.
I mean, how are we going to fact check that?
You know, I heard people in the 1300s or so were making Imperial Pumpkin Ales before recorded time. It's packed with pumpkin and roasted pumpkin seeds and spiced with cinnamon, nutmeg, cloves, and allspice. 8.4 alcohol by volume. Night Owl. This is kind of the signature Elysian pumpkin beer.
Absolutely.
The Night Owl Pumpkin Ale, our original pumpkin ale, brewed with pumpkin, roasted and raw pumpkin seeds. You're getting both of them in there. And spiced in conditioning with nutmeg, clove, cinnamon, ginger, and allspice, of course, for good measure. 6.7% alcohol by volume. We've got the Punkachino Coffee Pumpkin Ale, a pumpkin ale with the attitude of a world-weary barista. Punkachino packs a short shot of Stumptown coffee in your pint with just a shake of cinnamon and nutmeg, 6% alcohol by volume. And finally, the Dark O' the Moon Pumpkin Stout. Dark O' the Moon Pumpkin Stout is spookily smooth and chocolatey with a touch of cinnamon, 7.5% alcohol by volume. And I'll have to say, Elysian doesn't seem quite as excited about that one.
Lower key on that one.
So okay. We are starting off here today with...
Are we going to come back at the end of the pod and do our rankings from 1 to 4?
That is the Dark O' the Moon Pumpkin Stout and... The Night Owl.
A lot more sound effects on this pod than usual. All right, so what are we going to do here? You're going to pour half of this into each of these glasses, and then each of us takes one of the bottles?
And one will be a trick, and the other will be a treat.
I mean, hopefully they will both be treats, I would imagine, with all due respect to our good friends at Elysian. Okay, so we're starting with the...
Dark O' the Moon.
Dark O' the Moon. Well, here's that aforementioned toast to Sounders FC.
We went into this match expecting it to be a trick, and it turned out to be a treat.
How many times are we going to use that construction
today? I had
that
in my head the whole freaking
game. Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay, I've been waiting to say that for so long. Tonight, the Cube 93 haunted house was Bank of California Stadium. And this just in, bank is spelled with a K, people, not with a C.
Wow, real error that they've got there. Good fact-checking, good proofreading.
Thank you. You would think that Bob Bradley would have been used to elimination round losses after his tenure with the USMNT, but somehow he still did not learn. And while LAFC may have had one of the greatest Mexican soccer players in Vela, they do not have Raul Ruiz Diaz, who played a near-perfect match for the Sounders, guiding them to the MLS Cup.
So we went into this, as you said, thinking the Sounders were distinct long shots. I had a Twitter thread earlier laying out LAFC's dominant statistics from the regular season, how heavily they were favored going into this matchup. 538 Soccer Pundits gave the Sounders a 19% chance of advancing. That was actually better than the gambling market, which made LAFC 6-1 favorites going into this one. So, you know, but as I mentioned to conclude it, also, it was a single game matchup, and it's soccer, and shit can happen. And a lot of shit happened in this match.
The reason we do percentage chance of victory is because nothing is 100%.
Some things are 100%, but not this.
A 20% chance of victory can happen one out of every five times.
One out of five times, it works every time.
And this was the one out of five times. The Sounders had to play a near-perfect match in this game. They had to have really capitalized, not on every one of their opportunities. There were opportunities that they didn't score on, but on a lot of their opportunities, and had to do it in quick succession after going down.
Sorry, what was that word again?
Secession.
No, succession.
just like the hit TV show on HBO.
Yeah, so LAFC strikes first here in the 17th minute on an Edward Atuesta free kick, which was kind of surprising because you assumed, as Taylor Twellman mentioned repeatedly on the broadcast, it was him and Carlos Vela, LAFC's star, who had scored a record MLS record 34 goals during the regular season, both standing over that free kick from just outside the box. And instead of the left-footed Vela taking it, it was the right-footed Atuesta who drilled it into the upper right-hand corner of the net. Nothing Stefan Fry could do about that or anyone else. And you're thinking, uh-oh.
Yeah, it was over.
Yeah. But then the Sounders answered within 5 minutes with Raul Ruiz Diaz, his first goal in this match. And then 4 minutes after that, it's Nico Ladero on the counter, a really impressive run and an impressive strike from outside the box to give the Sounders the lead. And at that point, I don't know about you, but I'm thinking, when is the LAFC onslaught coming? Because they've given up goals before. They played a wild match against the Galaxy in their first playoff match. I think it finished 5-3 in that one. Like, they giving up goals is not unusual for them. They just outslug opponents, basically, if they were a baseball team. But it never came. And I think that's testament to a couple of things. First off, the Sounders had a good game plan here. Again, as Twellman mentioned on the broadcast, they did a great job of taking Diego Rossi out of the game. Even Vela wasn't that big of a factor, I would say. You know, LAFC had a lot of possession in this game, but it wasn't in dangerous places, except when Javier Arriaga was committing fouls in the box and potential handballs.
Mm.
And the other thing that stood out for this match that worked to the Sounders' benefit.
Can I just say, a handball has to be at least semi-intentional, right?
Yes, I think the
fans just like lose their shit every time they see anything that could remotely be a handball. Like, there's the ball that went off. Was it Ladero's side, or is that Arriaga?
I'm not sure which one that was.
And it was just like, it didn't even hit his hand. Even if it would have, it wasn't intentional. Just like, chill the F out.
The whole thing strikes me as pretty ridiculous. Like, yelling about that and like the players coming over to yell at the referee.
Uh-huh.
Like, there's video review now. If something happened, the referee has nothing to do with it. It's the guy up in the booth or you know, it's the person who's up in the booth who is checking it. They're going to determine what happens, not the referee. I mean, eventually they go over and look at the video, but they're the one who decides whether we stop the play, stop play. And there wasn't a single video review in this entire match that I recall, was there?
No.
But it was definitely, whether it was a directive from the league or his own initiative, the referee for this match, Jair Marufo, decided to let a lot of stuff go. And he let it go at both ends.
You think they let that much stuff go?
Yeah.
Because there were a lot of things where I'm like, I still think he made the right call on in every situation.
I mean, I think on the handballs were borderline at best, but a
you
lot
don't
of...
don't send a team to the MLS Cup on a bullshit handball that does not affect the play.
But Arriaga's fouls, he got away with a lot of stuff. Javier Arriaga, who started this match in place of Roman Torres, who came on as a substitute after injuring his hamstring in the quarterfinal round. The last two matches he had played during the MLS regular season had seen him get sent off both of those games after picking up a pair of yellow cards in those. And he did not learn anything from that.
Just he was kept, back for more. He
kept playing super physically an aggressive challenge early in the match, like a completely needless aggressive challenge. But I do think he got away with it, and I do think that the fact that the Sounders were able to be so physical, it played to their advantage, even though I don't think they were, like, the refereeing was specifically biased in their favor.
Was that physical?
They were very physical with Vela in particular, I think.
Because, okay. I mean, I saw this, and I felt like LAFC was taking a lot of sort of, like, not cheap shots, but just little moments, like elbows and things, and pushing.
Well, particularly at the end when they started to get frustrated, I think that was the case.
And the fans started throwing beer onto the field.
Yeah, that was great. But early in the match, the Sounders set a very physical tone that I don't think LAFC was ready for. And I think kind of took them off their stride a little bit. But anyways, the Sounders make it into halftime with the lead up 2-1. And then double their lead with Raul Ruiz Diaz's second goal of the match in the 64th minute. And then it was over a half hour of hang-on time. So much hang-on time.
Up two goals, though, it was just like, even in the amount of time where it's like, okay, if they score now, it would be pretty difficult for them to get back into it.
I mean, LAFC is just so scary that you're like, if they can get to one goal back, then it is going to be
definite. That second goal came in, it was over.
You mean the third goal?
Or sorry, when's the second goal, the second lead? When they had the two-goal lead, it was over.
I do not think it was over. I disagree with that
you
assessment.
You didn't feel that?
No.
Your fear level went down.
Even into stoppage time, I was extremely nervous about this
match.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, it's probably a testament to that I care less. But but if the Sounders would have lost this game, it probably wouldn't have ruined my day or something.
Right.
You know?
I mean, I went in with low expectations. I was managing my expectations. I was prepared to be okay either way.
But they scored that third goal, and I was like,
but if they had lost, but if they had lost after they were up 3-1, then it would have definitely ruined my
day. That would have been very depressing.
Yeah,
as much well, as just it, after the I felt like the antics of their crowd, it was like, oh, come on. The pushing and the fighting after that, and the way that Bob Bradley behaved after the match, their crowd was just like...
I know, it was weird because it started out as like a very pleasant conversation between him and Schmetz, and then it devolved into less pleasant conversation.
Not great, so, Bob. Not great.
Yeah, it wasn't the best. But, you know, Brian Schmetzer is someone who has been maligned at times. Not necessarily in this podcast, although, and I couldn't dig up the audio of this. I was very disappointed because I went looking for it. So, someone on this podcast suggested at midseason that Brian Schmetzer was going to get fired. I can't think, I'm not, I don't want to name any names, but it wasn't me.
Not great, Bob.
And instead, again, for the third time in 4 years, taking the Sounders to the MLS Cup final.
Incredible.
A place they had, technically speaking, never been before he took over as manager. With all due respect to the great, late, great Ziggy Schmidt. Schmetz, that's my guy forever, man.
And just like, this format, like, think about how fun this is, right?
It's a lot of fun.
The MLS has done an incredible thing. The season is still very long, but once you get to the playoffs, it's...
And it's not like they took the benefit of the regular season out of it, because the home field and the fact that LAFC got a bye...
No, the home field matters even more.
They were overwhelmingly likely to get there, but... anything can happen.
They, with this format, made the regular season matter more than it did in the home and home format.
But also made each playoff match matter more than it did. So they somehow made everything more important. It was a great change.
No, it's beautiful. I mean,
also, there's no international break coming up before the MLS Cup.
Wow, none?
Not a single one.
Are you sure?
I'm sure. There is going to be a week and a half until the MLS Cup, but that might not be such a bad thing since I haven't seen anything on Jordan Morris, who limped off the field a little bit in this match when he was subbed out in the second half.
But they made it so that everybody had to play soccer in every single playoff match.
Yeah.
It was great. It was fun to watch. You like getting it over with instead of being like, well, it was 1-1, so we're in a pretty good situation or whatever. I hate that. That's the worst thing about soccer.
Yeah.
Actually, the worst thing about soccer, I was so ready to complain about this before LAFC hit that free kick goal, was the play where like a hand went back and like sort of went toward, I think it was it Roldan's eye? And then he collapsed to the ground. And I was like, this is actually the worst thing about soccer.
Roldan is not a flopper. I assume that he actually got hit in the face. And as was pointed out on the broadcast, the fact that LAFC stopped playing there seemed to indicate they knew that that was legit.
I'm giving you a look as though it wasn't legit. There's just all sorts of stuff throughout the match where you're just like, I know that this is us doing it. I know that it benefits the Sounders, but like, really?
I mean, that wasn't like the 20th minute. That wasn't Rui Diaz going down in like the 87th minute or whatever. That's very different. Also, Brad Smith like ran so hard, he literally could not run anymore on that play where he had a breakaway. Oh, good times. So the Sounders do not yet know who their opponent will be in the MLS Cup final, which will be played on Sunday, November 10th. At 12 noon Pacific time on ABC, conveniently an off day for the Seahawks, who play Monday Night Football that week. Could have the back
to be in LA.
Not could. We'll have the back-to-back of Sounders in the MLS Cup on Sunday, Seahawks on Monday Night Football at the 49ers, potentially undefeated 49ers on Monday. I am not going to say anything about that week.
Oh,
I'm just not going to say anything about that week.
They're two separate weeks.
That's a good point. They will find out who they play on Wednesday night when the defending MLS Cup champion Atlanta United hosts Toronto FC in the Eastern Conference Final. The 538 Soccer Power Index aforementioned gives Atlanta a 70% chance to win. They'll host that one and then would host the final if they win. But if Toronto FC pulls the upset for the third matchup between these two teams in 4 years, if that happens... The rubber match, since those two teams have split a pair of MLS Cup finals in Toronto. In that case, the Sounders would, for the first time in their history, host the... Well, not I guess they hosted one, but they didn't play in it back then.
70% chance. Is that all?
I mean, I would like to play someone else besides Toronto FC in an MLS Cup final at some point, but obviously you have to root for Toronto.
At home.
Yeah.
Bring the MLS Cup back to Seattle.
Where it belongs.
I'm going to be in LA at a music festival that entire day. It's actually quite terrible for me.
I mean, I would definitely try to go to that one if we were to host the MLS Cup.
There's no try.
Why?
There is only two. You just go.
You have to get the tickets, but yeah.
It's not that... It's the year 2019.
They're going to, yes.
You can get tickets.
I'm just saying. I don't want to make any guarantees about anything. So the Sounders also, this actually happened ahead of this match with the outcome, with LAFC beating the LA Galaxy in the quarterfinal round, qualified for the 2020 CONCACAF Champions League. It will be the sixth appearance for the Sounders in the 11 seasons in which they've been eligible to play in CONCACAF Champions League, back in it after a one-year absence. Another toast to Vlatko.
That was our first toast.
That was a very long toast. Vlatko Andonovski, the former Reign FC manager, was named coach of the USWNT on Monday. He also earned NWSL Coach of the Year honors for the second time in his career on Saturday, ahead of that final that was won by the North Carolina Courage, who, after knocking out the Reign in the semifinals, then went on to beat Chicago Red Stars 4-0 in the finals. So Reign FC gave them their toughest test.
There we go.
En route to the championship.
And they record that in the history books.
They do. That's noted.
Toughest test.
We're still taking credit for that with the 2005 Sonics against the Spurs. Lastly, we are pouring some out tonight for Al Bianchi, who is the first coach of the Seattle Supersonics. As an expansion franchise, he died Monday at age 87 of natural causes. All right. I guess it's time for our NBA Seattle update, sponsored by Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci wants basketball back in Seattle. And so do we.
We want an opening night back in Seattle. It's been way too long now. 12 years. Yeah,
we would take anything.
Well, by definition.
I mean, an opening night or whatever.
Unless it's the one-off preseason game that we had a couple of years ago. Like, as long as you have the team here, you're going to have an opening night.
Yeah.
So 1 week of the NBA season in the books. Anything in particular you want to talk about from that first week?
Anthony Simons.
Had a really big game at Sacramento. Not a big opener for the Blazers. They lost to Denver at home in their season opener, but has had a couple of solid performances during this three-game road trip on which they're 2-1.
And is looking like a part of the rotation at the very least. Like, he's playing in crunch time for the Blazers right now.
Oh, I mean, there was never any question that he was going to be a part of the rotation. Yeah.
Markel Fultz.
So I watched him for the first time the other night. It was not one of the nights where he made 2 3-pointers and a half, which is the real thing that happened in an NBA game.
1 half, huh?
But, you know, he didn't shoot it particularly well in the half that I watched him play, but he was playing comfortably and free. He looked like UW Markel Fultz transported against NBA competition. So that was very encouraging to see.
Comfortable and free.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, you know, he was just playing without thinking out there.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
So we'll see how this holds up. I mean, obviously, you know, this time a year ago, he was starting for the Sixers.
Good so far?
Yeah, he's been pretty good.
Really?
I mean, he legitimately was important to their opening night win. He had 6 points and 6 assists in that game. You know, his true shooting percentage is still below league average, but he's making 62% of his two-point attempts, and his assist rate is really strong.
I mean, the main thing to me for Markel Fultz is that he's just playing basketball and nobody's really talking about it.
Which is, I think, the benefit for him. We talked about this when this happened, but of being in Orlando. Uh-huh. Like, the scrutiny is always going to be so great on him in Philadelphia, where he was the number one pick, the guy they traded away, you know, the pick that became Jason Tatum and another first-round pick to get all of that all of those elements, and then just the national attention on the Sixers, mm-hmm. the rabidity of their fan base. A little bit different, Orlando.
Yeah, no, it's really helped him, the NBA's goal of moving all of their franchises to the smallest possible markets.
I mean, Orlando's been there a long time.
Or expanding to the smallest possible market, sorry. That's one of the best things for Markel. And Matisse Thybulle, though, playing in Philadelphia and seeming like he's playing some significant minutes.
Yeah, he's basically their sixth guy at this point because they
have... Sixth man on one of the best teams in the league.
Yeah.
As a rookie.
They have such an interchangeable lineup that anyone who goes out, Matisse Thybulle can replace them.
Uh-huh.
So, because they're even
That's
playing...
also a testament to Matisse, though.
Nah. I mean, Matisse is versatile, but in this case, it's mostly the fact that Philly has this super large lineup that if they take a big man off the court, they can just slide Al Horford down to center. Or if you take Ben Simmons off the court, Josh Richardson has been serving as their backup point guard. So there's just a lot of versatility among their starters.
That is a crazy team.
Thybulle is already, like... I say this in the nicest... First off, I'm there is no greater Matisse Thybulle fan than me.
You're going to talk shit right now about Matisse Thybulle.
His defense is a little overrated right now. People are getting kind of out of hand. Like, people are talking about him like as if he's Scottie Pippen 2.0. Like, he's a rookie in his first week. Let's remain calm. He's going to make some mistakes, get beat sometimes.
Have you seen him get beat?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, like, sometimes he's overly aggressive in pursuit of steals, and that breaks down their defense. But I still think that one of my core basketball philosophies is that coaches are way too conservative when it comes to encouraging their players to pursue steals because they are the most valuable thing in basketball.
Steals are the most valuable thing in basketball.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, like a dunk. But, like, if you're looking at just an individual thing in the box score, a steal is the most valuable thing in the box score, more valuable than scoring a point.
So you think that it's okay that he's being aggressive trying to get steals?
Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But just let's cool on the defensive player of the year talk.
Rookie of the year MVP slash talk. Defensive player of the year slash MVP.
Bill Simmons looking up the MVP odds for Matisse Thybulle was a little far.
Really?
100%.
They're MVP odds from a
team. They're not. No. Say,
there cannot no, be of course MVP not. Odds.
He's a rookie reserve on the Sixers.
So far through the first week of the NBA season, are the Sixers the best team in the league?
No. Like, who's performed the best thus far?
Who's the best team in the league? Right now, in your opinion, off the top of your head. You're looking at stats. Clippers. I know you can't help yourself.
The Clippers are the best team. I mean,
they're better than Philadelphia.
I don't know if they've played better over the first week, but only one of those teams is playing without a guy who finished third in the MVP voting last year. So, you know, the Clippers got that going for them, which is nice.
Matisse is healthy.
Well, yeah.
It is pretty hilarious that, I mean, he was an extremely impactful player at UW, but the idea that he loved, like, looking up his MVP odds as a person who went to the NCAA tournament one time in his career.
Yeah.
Is he being asked to do anything on offense?
No. The Hawks the other night were like, this is a strategy they played against Markelle Fultz last year. And it's interesting because their head coach Lloyd Pierce was formerly the lead assistant in Philadelphia before he got hired by the Hawks. So they like aggressively were helping off of Matisse Thybulle and daring him to shoot threes the other night. And he made a couple of them.
He can knock down like three.
I don't think you can like treat him as a non-shooter. He's not Tony Allen out there.
Anthony Roberson.
No, it's Andre Roberson. 0-2 there. You spelled it correctly on the second part, but you didn't pronounce it correctly. Sadly,
Andre Roberson.
Sadly, Andre Roberson still has yet to see action this season. As soon as he does,
Oklahoma City
championship contenders.
Oh my god! They'll be saying Paul George who when Anthony Roberson comes back. It has been a pretty interesting NBA season so far, though, I have to say. Yeah. I was not anticipating getting this into the NBA this early, but the Blazers-Spurs game that happened on Monday night, and the couple of chances that the Blazers had at the end of that game, it was pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, Damian Lillard's three. Like, he can't go much farther into the hoop without going through the hoop. It was about as far down as you can go.
Well, speaking of some Husky players who are now in the NBA... what about the next generation of Husky players?
Well, UW Men's Basketball is going to play a game in front of fans this Thursday, their exhibition opener against Western Washington. But before that, they use their other exhibition game on the quote-unquote secret scrimmage, traveling to TCU and suffering a 61-58 loss, according to Percy Allen of the Seattle Times.
Now, let us take a step back and recall that last year they went into Nevada and beat Nevada in a scrimmage.
That is correct.
And it
was a charity game. That one was open to the public.
So excited about it.
Way too excited.
Nevada, where did they end up? They are an NCAA tournament team at the very least.
Yeah, they were a really good team. I mean, we were wrong about Nevada.
Let's pronounce Nevada.
Depends who you talk to.
You were wrong about Nevada. We were right about Nevada and how good they were going to be. But I had to get back to you for the Anthony Robertson thing. But these games don't matter.
They don't matter that much, but here's why I'm actually encouraged by the fact that the Huskies lost to TCU.
So I call them.
Exactly. We're into rationalization early in the season. No. So
here's why the Huskies losing their exhibition game to TCU is a good thing. Coming up next.
Great tease. If only we had a read to do here for
that
Pagliacci.
Was a Ryan Russillo thing.
It is. You can talk about the Pagliacci you had last week here.
What?
Pagliacci?
What about Pagliacci?
Did you have some?
It's great. Yeah. I did have some.
Okay.
I have it a lot. What? Oh, this is for our read?
Yeah, now we're coming back.
Before it happens. Pagliacci pizza, the double pepperoni, is just excellent.
Oh, it's twice the pepperoni.
Mm.
So
I've noticed, though. No single pepperoni.
Huh.
Yeah.
Really makes you think.
Not even on the menu.
Really makes you think.
You know what? We're not just about pro spawn con. Sometimes we're exposing things too. You know? We're able to look at Pagliacci objectively still.
I really thought that was coming much quicker than that. Okay. So here's the thing is,
We were tricked.
My friend Percy, in writing about this game, notes that TCU was
name-dropping Percy Allen as your friend.
Picked last in the Big 12 going into this season. They actually have 10 teams. So there's a couple things about this. First off, the Big 12 is just really good top to bottom.
Really?
The last place team in their preseason projections on KenPom.com would rank sixth in the Pac-12.
Well, you can't compare it to the Pac-12.
I mean, it's both like that the Pac-12 is bad.
Weird teams ranked in the Big West.
It's like 59.
Big Sky Conference.
All their teams are in the top 59. There's not like a, I don't know who the terrible, there's not a Penn State of the Big 12. Everyone there is good top to bottom. But here's the other thing is, TCU also is not the last place team in KenPom in their Big 12 projections. They have them, KenPom has them 46th, which is six spots ahead of UW. So
it was a close game.
On a neutral, on a neutral site, you would expect them to be about even. Traveling to Texas, TCU would be heavily favored. And then there's another factor on top of this, which is that both Quade Green and Jaden McDaniels, two of probably the three best players on the Huskies, did not play in this game. Quade Green, because they're still awaiting word on his transfer waiver, and God only knows when they will actually get that from the NCAA because they're so busy finally taking steps towards allowing players to make money off their name and likeness.
Wait, are we mad about this? What are you saying with this point?
No, that's good, but they're so busy with that, they have not had time to look at Quade Green.
Yeah, stop trying to pay the players, NCAA. We need to get Quade Green playing right now.
They're playing a game in 2 days. Could we maybe get an answer on this? It doesn't seem like too much to ask. It's the waiver was filed months ago. It's October 29th. Like, come on, let's speed this up. And then Jaden McDaniels, unclear why he didn't play in this game. Percy did not know a reason, so
maybe he just didn't feel like it.
It's a little disconcerting that he's now they've played five games exhibitions and he has not played in any of them at this point. But presumably he will play in this exhibition against Western on Thursday.
We'll see. Are you going?
Yeah.
Oh,
I will be there. That's my Halloween plans. Yeah.
Hello.
It's the prospect of playing Western in an exhibition game always spooky.
Ooh.
Without those two players, the Huskies started Elijah Hardy, Naz Carter, Jamal Bay, Isaiah Stewart, and Sam Timmons.
I love that they have the Carter and Bay in the starting lineup. You had not thought about that until right now.
Wow.
You can have the tweet. It's all yours.
Thanks. Set that out on a silver platter for me. I like that. Naz Carter with 20 points in this one to lead the Huskies. And Isaiah Stewart went for a double-double of 14 points and 11 boards. Naz Carter now being regarded as an NBA prospect.
Really?
Yeah, he is in the top 100 on our ESPN draft rankings for 2020.
It took Jalen Noel about 2 full years to get into that top 100.
Well, Naz has been here 2 years. I don't know if you're aware of that.
The 40th pick in the draft, and he just cracked the top 100.
Desmond Bain, who was the leading returning scorer in the Big 12, led TCU in that one with 26 points. So, again, exciting to see this team on the court after we've talked about them for such a long period of time here.
I mean, we didn't see them on the court, but you will.
No, I mean, it's going to be exciting to see them on the court. All right, also in Husky Athletics, football returns from a bye this Saturday to host number 9 Utah in a rematch of last year's Pac-12 championship, but not, sadly, a preview of this year's Pac-12 championship. The Utes enter this game tied with USC atop the Pac-12 South at 4-1, looking to get back after that 10-3 loss to UW in last year's Pac-12 championship. They do currently lose that tiebreaker as their lone loss came 30-23 at USC. All 7 of Utah's wins have come by at least 18 points this season, but they have lost the last 4 matchups with the Huskies since winning in Seattle in 2015 during Jake Browning's freshman season.
Can I just, for a second here, say, throughout the beginning of the season, every sort of like college football pundit that there was like tripping over themselves to be like, the Pac-12 is not going to have a playoff team, but, and now there are two teams that if they went undefeated would have a fairly good shot of making the playoff.
Yeah, I mean, the Oklahoma loss opened the door a little bit.
But that's what's going to happen, Stuart Mandel. Like, you don't need to say,
We're specifically calling people out now.
But no, I'm just saying, like, I distinctly remember him tweeting, like, the Pac-12 is not going to have a playoff team, but that doesn't mean that they don't have fun games. It's like, dude, it's early October.
I mean, I made that comment last week, in fairness.
Well, you're fucking wrong, Kevin Pelton. ESPN's Kevin Pelton. I mean, they might not, but saying there are two teams with one loss.
Yeah.
And I remember a team with one loss to USC that still made the college football playoff.
And who is that team? It was the 2017 Huskies.
17? That can't be right.
Yeah, it was 2 years ago. Or 16. No,
it was
16.
A lot longer. You're right.
2017 was Penn State in the Fiesta Bowl.
Browning was the quarterback. But yeah, also, so Oregon's one loss is at the last second to Auburn, who still are a very good team.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, everybody cool the fuck out here.
Until both of these teams inevitably lose to Oregon State.
I mean, Oregon is looking very likely to be undefeated going to the Pac-12 championship.
They're looking good to be. I mean, Utah, if they get through Saturday, their last three games are relatively easy.
I'm not saying
this is their toughest test remaining by far.
So you could reasonably have a Pac-12 championship of Utah versus Colorado. Well, both of them have one loss.
Yes.
Go Utah. No. I'm actually cheering for them on Saturday, turns out.
Oh, no.
No. Because so, they are not going to go into that game with one loss.
Oh, you're that confident. So the rankings indicate that this is a very lopsided game. Utah number 9, UW unranked. If you look at the advanced statistics,
hell,
not so fast. Utah comes in 13th in ESPN's Football Power Index. UW checks in at 15th and is a slight favorite in this game because of home field advantage. Despite the fact that Utah has been really quite terrific this season. They rank in the top 10 in FPI efficiency on both offense, 8th, and defense, 5th. The defensive aspect of it, not so surprising. They've consistently been an elite defense under Kyle Whittingham, who's a defensive-minded coach. The offense is a bit of a change this year, and it really reflects how well Tyler Huntley is playing at quarterback as an experienced veteran.
Are you able to quickly see how many other teams are in the top 10 in FPI in both offense and defense? Because I would assume that we're talking the highest echelon of teams here who are in the top 10 there. I would assume we're talking Alabama, Clemson, LSU, and Ohio State or something like that. Even those.
It's going to take some memorization on my part because they don't show the ranks on here. But it looks like, yes, Clemson, Ohio State pretty clearly are. Alabama is, yes, Utah, and I think that is it. I think that it is those four teams.
The exact ones that I named?
Yeah.
Wow. Who is that one? It's 36. Oh, Wazoo.
What?
Wazoo is the fifth best offense in the country, and
oh, yeah. Yeah, they're very bad at defense.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, they're ahead of Georgia State, though, so that's good.
Well, wait, they have the second worst defense in the country?
No. I'm just saying, among those teams that are really good in offense, they are, in fact, 97th in defense.
All right, well. But so, I mean, Utah, offensively and defensively, having that complete package, we're talking about a team that's ranking with basically what we would consider the college football playoff at this point.
Yeah, well, okay, so a couple things. Number one, they are better in terms of FPI efficiency, which looks strictly at performance this season, than they are in overall football power index, which also, you know, starts from a starting point of what they expect coming into the season. But then the other aspect of it is Utah has historically been very good at special teams, good to even elite on special teams. Like, they've been, you know, frequently in the top 10 in the country under Whittingham. And this year, they rank 114th out of 130 FBS teams in special teams. So there's one place the Huskies can win this game. It is on special teams, where they this year are the elite team at number 5.
It really is just like, you couldn't have figured out good special teams last year, Coach Pete.
It's frustrating. So anyway, let's talk about Tyler Huntley, who is 5th in the NCAA and tops in the Pac-12 in QBR. He's completing 73% of his passes, which ranks 5th in the FBS, for 10.6 yards per attempt, which ranks 4th. He has thrown just one interception in 167 pass attempts this season, and also has 229 rushing yards, though he hasn't been particularly effective in terms of QBR EPA.
So we have all these conversations about these tall quarterbacks in the Pac-12.
Yeah. Herbert.
Herbert and Eason. And the real best quarterback in the Pac-12 is
Tyler Huntley.
Right there in front of us the entire time.
Yeah.
And it's Tyler Huntley.
Not an NFL first round prospect, as it turns out. You know, it happens. Utah, a very balanced receiving attack. No receiver has more than 18 catches this season, but they have 10 players with at least 8 catches. Watch out for Brian Thompson, who's averaging 26.5 yards per catch, which ranks 5th in FBS among players with at least 10 catches. And also notably among this receiver core is Samson Nakua, the older brother of Puka, who has 10 catches for 147 yards and 2 touchdowns. Totals that Puka, I think, has if not surpassed, he's going to get there pretty quickly. At running back, Zach Moss is averaging 6.6 yards per carry with 10 touchdowns. Moss left the USC game with an apparent shoulder injury and missed the win over WSU, but has been back and perfectly effective since then. For the second consecutive game sandwiched around this bye, the Huskies will be facing an elite pass defense. Utah's 5.6 yards per attempt ranks 8th in the FBS. They're also 2nd in FBS with 2.5 yards per carry allowed. So Utah excelling at all elements of defense. Not a particularly fearsome pass rush. Bradley Ane has 7 sacks, but just one other player has more than one on the season. And they don't force many turnovers, 1.5 per game. But, you know, just kind of play per play, you're not getting many yards against them.
Well, and I don't know who told the Pac-12 that they could start playing defense. But we've been saying this throughout the year. This is the best defense that Jacob Eason will face. This is the best defense that Jacob Eason will face. And
Oregon was going into the game until Eason torched them for 3 quarters.
And then Wazoo really kind of did whatever they wanted against Oregon also, their defense. Yeah. Maybe they have dropped the charm, though. Maybe this is the best defense that Jacob Eason will face. Or will they be able to do a similar thing? I mean, we saw USC on that Friday night early on in the season with their big receivers really kind of have at this Utah secondary.
Oh, good. UW has big receivers now? No, the young players, Puka Nakua.
You don't need big receivers Hunter necessarily. Bryant. But they had receivers who were going up and making big plays, but also getting open.
I mean, one of the things I'm really excited to see in this matchup is the extent to which the receiver rotation, because presumably Aaron Fuller will be back with a bye week to rest his ankle injury.
No one knows, though.
No, yeah, we'll find out until an hour before kickoff.
The spookiest thing about this week is the Husky injury report.
I look forward to Mike Farrell's tweet at 12 p.m. on Saturday and finding out whether he's going to play and Sean McGrew, whether they're going to play. Chico McClatcher, it sounds like, is ahead of schedule in terms of the injury, or at least it wasn't as severe as it looked when he left the game against Oregon. So we'll see, probably not in the mix this week. It seems like Andre Bocelli probably lower on the JEP chart at this point. And, you know, I think we're all excited to see more of the young receivers for now alongside Fuller.
But also having a more complete running back rotation, I guess.
Yeah.
We don't really know the status of anybody, assuming Newton is out.
It seems unlikely that Newton will be back this week.
But if they can get Sean McGrew back, and having both McGrew and Ahmed in the mix.
Yeah.
It's a significantly better rotation there.
I mean, that's a rotation we saw at Arizona, and that was quite effective there. Utah special teams, they lost Mitch Wisnowski, their All-American punter, who is now punting for the Cleveland Browns, and have fallen to 11th in yards per punt in the Pac-12.
That's who the punter. I heard Bill Simmons talked about talking at the long-haired punter.
Yeah, it's Wisnowski.
It's Wisnowski.
Yeah. All right. Also, their 14.2 yards per kick return are last in the Pac-12 by a wide margin. Everyone else is averaging at least 20 yards per kick return. So I don't know what's happening on special teams with Utah, but everything else is great except that.
Well, they're too busy having top 10 offense and defense. Well, let me just say,
and they've also had
excellent special teams leads you to 2-3 in the Pac-12.
No one has laid down in the end zone for them on any kick return this season, as it turns out.
The trick plays are back.
Percentage chances of victory here.
The trick is on us. I think they're better than... I think this is a 50-50 game. Maybe even a little bit better. I'm going to give the Huskies a 53% chance of victory.
Oh, 53. That is almost precisely what FPI says. I think they're at 52. So you're right on the money there. And I am more conservative because I noted that Utah is top 10 in both offensive defense and UW is not. So I'm going 45% chance of victory in this one.
Peyton Henry game, if ever there was one. Mm. No,
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I mean, we saw 2 weeks ago the offense playing extremely well against a very good defense.
And we saw the defense playing. I don't know. I don't have a good feel for, even though I've watched a couple of Utah games, I don't have a feel for how Huntley has been so successful or how it, you know, kind of interacts with UW's young secondary.
There have been 2 weeks off. I sort of give the Husky coaching staff and young players some credit here that maybe they've tightened up a little bit and they can get one stop in the second half.
They got one stop.
All right, two stops.
One stop in the fourth quarter, perhaps.
Or they just get the ball last and maybe they're able to score there. You know,
that's what happened 2 years ago against Utah, a game that they needed to win to get to the college football playoff. Like one of the forgotten great wins of this era, honestly.
You're confusing. That was not to the playoff. The game where they came on and kicked the field goal to win the game.
Whatever they call it, the New Year's Six.
There's a pretty big difference.
Fine, to play Penn State.
When they played in the Fiesta Bowl.
It was a good time.
They needed a game where they had to rush on the field goal kicker, somebody.
Oh boy, that was a long time ago. I do not remember who made that kick.
Had to rush them on to kick a field goal to win that game.
But had to go like 60 yards in three plays to get there at the end of that after having done nothing all game. And was it like pushing midnight at that one?
That's nothing anymore. Yeah. Pushing midnight. Call me when they're playing a game at 3 a.m.
True, but that's going to turn out to be the Huskies' only night game of the year at home. Because the Apple Cup is a day game.
Oh, I considered that an early morning
game. You do? Okay. I appreciate that you consider it then. Have we filled enough time for me to look up the name of the kicker who made that field goal?
I didn't know you were doing so.
It turns out we have not.
Their name is 404 Air.
Oh, it's that kind of podcast. Oh. Tristan Vizcaino.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, there we go. That's
one of the best Tristans to ever be on the Husky football team.
I mean, certainly a much better UW career than Tristan Etienne, Canadian basketball
Real
player
bust.
Who enrolled.
And you know what? My time on the Husky football team was not great either.
The Flake football team?
Oh, yeah, we didn't win a game.
Yeah, no, that wasn't so great.
You know what? I just felt like Tyrone Willingham being our coach was not the best strategy.
God, can you imagine Tyrone Williams? I mean, is this time for the weekly Flake football update, coaching update? Or you just don't even want to talk about because you suffered your first defeat as a Flake football offensive coordinator?
It was actually kind of awesome, right? The only thing that...
The game came down to a final play.
It was exciting stuff.
A two-point conversion for the win where I urged you to go for the win until I realized that before I learned it, there was an overtime.
You didn't know there was overtime.
Woefully under.
Okay. Let me set the scene here, right? So we're playing the hated Broncos, right?
Oh, man.
AFC West rivals.
No love lost between the Broncos and the Chargers.
It's kind of true also. Even you were getting in the mix. You were starting to kind of hate them too, weren't you?
They're children, so no.
Not the players, but you always hate the coaches, not the players. Right?
It's a little annoyed.
The coaching staff was getting your goat. So it turned out that we thought the game mattered with regards to the Flag football playoffs, but it ended up not mattering at all. Our seating was already set for the Flag football playoffs. So really, this is like week 17 to us, right? And if we had backups to play,
you had literally any backups. The other team had two full squads.
I sometimes think about sort of the disadvantage that we have that the Chargers in this Flag football league won the league by having one player who's like 2 years younger than anybody else and doesn't really seem to know what's going on. And then also with no backups whatsoever. And we're playing against the Broncos, who's like the coaching staff is like picking players up and throwing them and yelling stuff and talking shit. And they have an offense and a defense. And I'm like, everybody just...
Well, no, they just had two separate units.
But...
It was not like they had they were platooning out there.
Recognize what you're like getting hyped about. But so we're down by a point, right? Extra points, I would say, have been our Achilles heel throughout the year.
Yeah. These are not kicked, of course. These are converted. You can only go for conversions, even though they can be for either 1 point or 2 points, depending on the location.
And I would say that extra points have been our Achilles heel, because most of the touchdowns that we've scored on the Chargers have been like the equivalent of 80-yard touchdown runs. So by the time we get to the extra point, the good player is tired. So that really makes the extra points much more difficult because we don't want to give them the ball again. So we're down by a point and need like the equivalent of like 30 yards for a first down. It's basically fourth and 30. So Luca, our quarterback, we're running our flea flicker play. And I'm like, Luca, just don't throw a pick. Whatever you do, don't throw a pick. But I'm like, if we turn it over here and then they come down and score, the most likely scores will be down by 7. So we can still come back, run the good player a few times, and score a touchdown before the end of the game. Luca throws a pick. They score a touchdown on the very next play, miss the extra point, so they're up by 7 at that point. We have like 3 plays left. I don't know how much time is on the clock as the coach, because nobody says anything.
Let's be clear, you're the offensive coordinator.
As the offensive coordinator, I have no idea how much time is on the clock, but I'm just like yelling at these children to get to the line quickly. I'm like, go fast, go fast, go fast. So we give it to the good player. He gets to like the 5-yard line or something, or actually right outside of the pass only zone, which is like the last 5 yards. And I'm like, oh crap, we do not have a lot of plays left. Time is clearly running out. So I'm talking to another player, Presley, and I'm like, Presley, we're giving you the ball here. You need to score. And the players love when you tell them that as 7-year-olds. And she's like, got it. And then she doesn't score. So then I give it to Tobias. He's like LaDainian Tomlinson in 06 or something, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
And I'm like, Tobias, this is the last play of the game. You need to score. And then he fucking scored. He did the damn thing. And so I'm like, I'm yelling at the ref after that. He's like, do you want to go for 1 or 2? It's farther away if you go for 2. And I'm like, what happens if we go for 1?
And I'm throwing up the 2.
Right? I'm like, what happens if we go for 1? He's like, overtime, which I have no idea what the rules around overtime are. I'm like Donovan McNabb out there. I think there might be a second overtime.
I'm not really sure what the ref knows the rules either. But also, if you go for 2, it allows you to run. If you go for 1, you have to pass, which is a low percentage proposition with 7 and 8-year-olds, so, as it turns out.
So then I have you on the sideline, and you're like, 2. And I'm like, yeah, we're going to have some balls here. We are going for 2. Also, we couldn't have completed a pass. I don't even know why I was considering going for 1.
I was calling you Tom Osborne, but Tom Osborne went for 2, so I don't know why that was like a term I should have been yelling at you. Like, go for it, Tom Osborne. I don't know what year that was, the national championship where he went for 2 before there was overtime in college football and lost.
I'm trying to think if there's like really, has there ever been like a notable going for 2 and winning?
I mean, like in an important game?
Yeah. Can you think of any? It must have happened.
I mean, it
I can only think of terrible situations or whatever.
Well, like, I can only think of meaningless games, like when Jack Del Rio went for 2 in New Orleans and they got it.
There were some going for 2s this year that teams definitely lost when they were trying to win the game.
Did the Dolphins lose?
Brian Flores.
Did they lose?
Anyway, so you're like, go for 2. And I'm like, fuck it. We're going for 2. We're ending this right here, this flag football season. And so I dial up literally our best play, right? It's a play where we play action to one direction, and then we hand it off to the other direction, right?
Yep.
Unstoppable. The entire game, we've basically scored on that every single play. So we play action it to another kid, and then hand it off to the other direction to 06 LT, right? And he gets the ball in his hands on the handoff. It is wide open. Right.
So I reviewed the video of this earlier today because I filmed that play.
But you actually filmed the play? I need to watch this.
Yeah. It's not as open as you thought it was.
For him, though?
He probably would have scored, but the defender did stay home on that side of the field.
All right. One defender stayed home. But I mean, you need a couple of defenders to get him.
Probably.
And the ball slips out of his hands on the run. The only time all season. He has dropped the ball on a handoff.
And play is immediately dead.
Play is immediately dead.
When the ball hits
and the Broncos celebrate like they won the fucking Super Bowl, right? They celebrated like Malcolm Butler just picked off the pass. And I'm like, y'all, we're going to be playing in the gold round of the playoffs next week against the Seattle Packers and their quarterback, Aaron Rodgers. And you're going to be playing in the consolation league. I hope you're happy. Wait, who is the Broncos quarterback this week? You don't even know. Ain't Drew Locke and it ain't Joe Flacco.
It's not either of those two. It's great.
So I hope you're happy with your head coach, Vic Fangio.
First off, their defense has been very strong lately. Second off, I'm not going to happy shame 7 and 8 year olds.
Okay? They were out there. I'm telling you, they're acting. It wasn't the kids. It was the coaches who were celebrating more than the kids. There also were tears shed on our side. And I'm like, I kind of loved it just for the poetic nature of it all, right? That we had this one play and the only time that he dropped the ball was on, like, just being in a moment where you have one play to win the game is always exciting, right?
Well, the Seahawks tried to make sure that happened on Sunday after leading 24-0 at halftime.
I'll update you on what happens against the Packers next week.
Yeah, sadly, I'm going to have to miss that game because it's opposite UW-Utah.
Yeah, sadly, I'm going to have to miss the UW versus Utah game.
You don't sound that sad about it.
Send Peyton Henry my regards as he's kicking a game-winning field goal.
Okay. How much do we want to talk about this game against the Falcons and Matt Schaub, who threw for 390 yards? No, he went over 400. What did you go with? Finish with?
I don't know.
It was a lot of yards.
Who cares?
The Seahawks 7-0. Seahawks 7-0 when opponent quarterbacks throw for 400 yards. Truthers care.
Do we even need to talk about that?
The Seahawks should probably pass the ball more than one time in the third quarter, even when they lead.
No. I mean the sort of like 400 yard thing. It's like it's basically just like a statistical oddity that doesn't matter. Like,
oh, yeah, that means 7-0. Yeah, like
if you lower the number to 375 yards or whatever. Like, is it completely different?
I don't know if it's completely different, but
if you lower it to 350, it's like they happen to get lucky to win a couple of games. Here's the thing. The two situations that quarterbacks tend to throw for a lot of yards against the Seahawks are in blowouts. Like, that's pretty much what Pete Carroll's saying, which is true. You know, like, you throw for a lot of yards in games where you have to pass a lot.
Yes.
I mean, it's the same as the idea that you run the ball a lot in games that you win. But
yes.
The other situation that happens is when they're letting Russ cook.
That
he has
true.
Got the cauldron going. And in those games, other quarterbacks might be throwing for yardage, but so is Russ.
Oh, I love it when they let Russ cook, which they only do in the red zone. No, not anywhere else on the field.
And not in the second half.
No. It was disconcerting because Julio Jones was running wide open through the Seahawks secondary a lot in this game. I mean, Trey Flowers was sitting out, so hopefully that was a big factor in it.
If you want to talk about truthers out there, I'm a Trey Flowers and Quandre Diggs truther, which we haven't talked about Quandre Diggs.
We have not. That trade happened after we last recorded.
Let me just say,
I don't know that I have much of a take on Quandre Diggs.
He has. Let's say that the secondary is not Tedrick Thompson. It has to be an upgrade.
That is accurate.
So,
but if
that's your take on Quandre Diggs,
if McDougal is healthy, I want to see Marquise Blair out there. Marquise Blair is the future. He played well. And
what about a three safety set? That's the thing where I'm like,
it's possible. So obviously Quandre Diggs before moving to safety had previously played in the slot. It's possible that that's part of what the Seahawks see as value as being.
And a lot of things. I mean, we haven't talked about this trade. I personally think it was an excellent trade.
And I have no strong opinion about this trade, which is the only
he's locked
the
up.
Only trade the Seahawks made they before the
very
deadline.
Little for it. But first on Quandre Diggs.
Yeah, I just wanted to know.
Very little. Yeah, everybody knows. If you're listening to this podcast, you know the Seahawks didn't make any other trades.
What? Rashad Penny didn't get traded?
We're not breaking news here.
Oh, same.
God. They have him locked up for another 2 years, guarantee free. They can move on at any point that they want. And they had to trade, a swap of fifth for a seventh?
That is correct.
It's a no-brainer. I mean, it's the perfect trade,
sure. Basically.
People always talk about like why the NFL doesn't trade in the same way that the NBA does. And I think a lot of it is like the cost. Like the Lions have to pay a chunk of money to have made this trade.
Yes.
I kind of don't get it from the Lions' perspective, why they were willing to eat these bonuses.
You know who else doesn't get it?
All Lions fans. Every single Lions player and fan.
Members of the team don't get it. Probably the coaching staff. They may not get it either.
Literally nobody except for the Lions front office get it. But whatever. But I mean, having to eat the bonus. And that's at the time that you make the trade, right?
Yes.
Very different than the NBA.
Very different, yes.
So you can't really view the two leagues sort of apples to apples.
I mean, the NFL is becoming more NBA-like by the day. We're leading the way for the NFL out of the darkness. We saw
your centers or running backs take.
I guess actually the NFL was ahead on that one. But there was another trade where a team rented out its cap space, the Aqib Talib trade.
Yeah,
to get a draft pick. So that's a very NBA trade.
If you were to look at the secondary, let's say that this week going into the Buccaneers game, which we'll be talking about this, they're playing against a formidable passing offense.
Wait, are they?
Well, we know that they're playing against two very good receivers.
With a dangerous passing offense.
And the secondary looks something like Shaquille Griffin, who looks like a Pro Bowl corner this year. Trey Flowers healthy. Are you skeptical about Shaquille?
No. I'm looking at the beers as I'm compiling my ranking.
They all kind of taste the same.
No, I don't agree with that.
They all taste like pumpkin. Trey Flowers being healthy. A safety tandem of Marquise Blair and Bradley McDougal, potentially. Condre Diggs being able to play in the nickel. I mean, like, it's an upgrade from Jamar Taylor. Nico Thorpe or Akeem King or whatever.
We'll see how the Seahawks intend to use him. We'll see.
Or Michael Kendricks being on the field all the fucking time.
He's on the field. Hey, he had an interception in this one. So
anyway, I think it was a great trade.
But Julio Jones was open so much of the time. That's my main point here. And that's a concern to me. Because then you do have a team that has two of those guys coming this week. That they certainly have.
They don't have two Julio Joneses.
You're right. Both of those guys have been much more effective than Julio Jones this season. What am I talking about? Let's talk about the Seahawks at midseason. The win brings them to 6-2 on the year, and yet their playoff odds still hover around 50% in most statistical projections because of the combination of A, an exceedingly difficult remainder of the schedule, and B, an exceedingly loaded NFC and NFC West in particular, with the 49ers still undefeated and the Rams winning again in dominant fashion to move to 5-3 on the season, one game back of the Seahawks. So how do we feel about the Seahawks at midseason?
It's weird. It's weird because you can't feel bad about them being 6-2.
No.
Preseason, if you're like, the Seahawks could be 6-2, 8 games through. You hearing bats over there? You would take it 100 times out of 100, right?
Yeah.
Especially, undefeated on the road.
Yeah. It's winning 3 10 a.m. starts.
At the same time, the thing that you wouldn't take is the NFC has probably, if you run 1,000 simulations, like 95th percentile of difficulty in the NFC in general.
I mean, certainly the 49ers again being undefeated, yeah.
So, I mean, but not even just that, like the Packers being excellent, the Saints being excellent without, if you were like Drew Brees is going to miss most of the games this year.
Including the one in Seattle.
Yeah, they're going to be, are they 6-1 or 7-1?
I think
with only one loss,
7-1
halfway through the year,
they have not hit their bye yet. This week is their bye, so yes.
The Vikings looking very dangerous. I mean,
the Vikings learning that they're allowed to pass.
Yeah, I didn't like anything about that.
No, I'm not a fan.
So that's the part where, I mean, even if the Seahawks win this game, we talked about this last week. It was like, even if they win the next two, their chances of making the playoffs are not going to go up by that much.
Yeah.
So. The game that the playoff odds are really going to hinge on is in 2 weeks, or if they lose. But as long as they
and then also when they face the Rams in LA, those three games in
I mean, the Vikings game is going to be huge. Yeah, I mean, no, yeah.
Pretty much everyone. So a couple of thoughts on the schedule the rest of the way. Third Pelton brother Mike Sando tweeted on Monday that the Seahawks have the hardest remaining schedule in terms of...
I'm a Corsino, for the record.
In terms of remaining win percentage of their opponents, or win percentage of their remaining opponents, I should say. Third Pelton brother Ben Baldwin pointed out that 538's model favors the Seahawks in only two remaining games the rest of the season, this week against Tampa Bay and then against Arizona in, I believe, week 16 at home. And they will be underdogs in their other six remaining games.
I mean, you can't say that now, but yes. We don't know what those teams are going to look like at those times.
Sure, but the model says they will be an underdog in the other six remaining games. So the other thing I wanted to talk about is the idea that the Seahawks tend to play better in the second half of the season, which used to be true.
Oh, no.
It is not anymore. So I went through and looked at their Football Outsiders DVOA through eight games throughout the Pete Carroll era, as well as at the end of the season. A remarkable stat. In the last 8 years, the 8 years that Russell Wilson has played quarterback for the Seahawks, this is the fifth time that they have ranked precisely ninth DVOA through eight games. Huh. They are almost, they just hone in on that ninth spot. The other two times they were second, third, and fourth. So in the first 8 years that Pete Carroll was the Seahawks coach, not the first 8 years, I should say, the first 7 years, the Seahawks improved their DVOA by an average of 14.2 percentage points in the second half, which is a huge jump.
That's good.
The last 3 years, their DVOA has declined each time.
That's bad.
By an average of 9.0 percentage points. So this notion that the Seahawks are like automatically going to get better over the course of the season, not a guarantee anymore. Not a given. So this is also the third consecutive year that they have been precisely ninth at midseason. They finished 14th in 2017 when they missed the playoffs and 12th last year.
So declined both years.
Yeah.
Despite like a win over Kansas City last year in the second half of the season.
I mean, I think one thing that also kind of interacts with this is the idea that Russell Wilson isn't, and the Seahawks in general, are not as good in the rain. And it turns out it rains a lot more in Seattle in the second half of the season.
Global warming!
I don't know. I think that was probably always true. There was that remarkable, you talked about it, the streak where they didn't have any rain at Central League Field for like years after it was built. But that was pretty random.
Then global warming happened.
It rains a lot in Seattle in October and November, as it turns out, in
December. It's probably just randomness, though. Like, do you feel like the NFL has been scheduling differently the last few years?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
In terms of, like, the NFC West games are all at the end of the season?
Yeah.
No, I think that's kind of always been the philosophy.
Okay. Just the NFC West is very good right now.
Yes. Yes, as it turns out. All right, also on the topics this week, Justin Britt left Sunday's game early on with what was diagnosed subsequently as a season-ending ACL tear. Seahawks got good play the rest of that game from Joey Hunt. So how do we feel kind of about the impact of this on the rest of the season?
I mean, it definitely affects the depth
going
forward.
Ethan Posick on IR.
Well, seeing Dwayne Brown coming back, seeing DJ Fluker coming back, like the offensive line, it was just like the offensive line is finally all together. And I mean, you think about that depth that they have when they have Fluker back and Dwayne Brown back before the Justin Britt injury. And it's like you have three pretty capable backups there at the very least in Hunt, Jamarco Jones, and George Fant.
Who you get to play at tight end again.
And then. No, I mean, this still doesn't severely affect that, though, because they still do. I mean, thinking about Jamarco Jones, who played pretty well in his time in the starting lineup, and now he's back to the bench. Like, that's a good place to be for the Sounders, for the Seahawks.
So I guess Jordan Roos, who was promoted from the practice squad, becomes the backup center at this point until Posick is back. I don't know how much experience he has playing center.
Let's just pray for Joey Hunt's health.
Hunt, you know, a little bit undersized compared to Britt, but has been effective as a pass blocker. And
I mean,
the Seahawks pass blocking in this
game. He was the best pass blocker on the Seahawks offensive line.
Yeah. So.
So maybe they'll just pass the ball all the time.
Sure.
Uh-huh.
That's definitely what will happen.
This is going to be the catalyst.
Especially this week when they're facing a terrible pass defense and a great run defense. But first, let's talk about the Buccaneers offense, which ranks 20th in DVOA. Jameis Winston has been pretty bad this year. But the aforementioned Ben Baldwin has put together a quarterback metric that combines EPA, expected points added per play, and completion percentage over expectation based on depth of the pass and location, that sort of thing.
Now, how much does this stat confirm my priors?
Oh, a lot.
Okay, then. This is a good stat.
Yeah. Mm. So he's 23rd in that. We thought that this was going to be a really good marriage of Jameis and Bruce Arians because Jameis has the strong arm and, you know, has been effective throwing deep. He's got great receivers who are good at going deep, and that's the crux of Bruce Arians' offense, and it hasn't really taken. His 58% completion percentage is a career low and ranks 31st of 32 qualifying quarterbacks. And even though Winston has increased his yards per completion from 12.3 to 13.5, which ranks second in the NFL, he has thrown a league-high 12 interceptions at the highest rate of his career, which ranks 29th. And he's also taking sacks way more frequently, ranking 29th by taking sacks on 9.6% of his dropbacks this
Maybe
season.
Can we get a sack? Is this the week?
This might be the week. I think this is the week.
I mean, you saw that stat. I think this is also something that Ben tweeted about, of pressures versus sacks. And like Jadeveon Clowney is off the charts with regard to pressures.
His pass block win rate is fourth in the league, I believe.
It's like, I mean, you would look at it not advanced statistically speaking and assume that Jadeveon was not having that great of a season. But it's like, I mean, we've talked about this. Stats are, they're a coincidence, right? Stats are
sacks, that far,
but sacks are largely luck. And you would take, let's say, this season that Jadeveon is having this year with his pass rush win weight versus the Frank Clark season last year where he happened to get home.
And we've seen that in Kansas City where Frank Clark, before his injury, was not generating sacks, especially because of the fact that he didn't have the kind of, you know, he's got ineffective secondary play there in Kansas City. So,
But maybe this is the week. I mean, basically, when you combine for Jameis, the interest in getting the ball down the field, just you can think about all the things. This is all the stuff that conservative coaches stay up at night scared of, right? Mike Zimmer sweats
every
night.
You can say Pete Carroll.
No, but Pete Carroll likes the explosives.
He does, but he doesn't like turnovers, and he doesn't like. I guess he's okay with sacks, but he doesn't like interceptions. And Russell Wilson, as it turns out, doesn't throw a lot of interceptions. Yeah, it's a good knock on wood there.
But thinking about Mike Zimmer pouring sweat, right?
Just thinking about throwing 12 interceptions through the first half of the season. How long do we think we have to go back to find 12 interceptions for Russell Wilson?
For a season?
No, like total. Like how far back? Because I assume it's beyond last season.
Oh, yeah.
He threw 7 last season. So, yeah, we have to go into the 2017 season to find 12 interceptions ago for Russell Wilson. He has never had 12 in a season.
But, I mean, you can just imagine, like, Jameis is holding onto the ball longer while his receivers get downfield, right?
Yeah.
He's making more dangerous throws by throwing the ball down the field. He's throwing more incompletions. He's taking more
sacks.
But
his decision-making has also not been good.
I mean, also, like, Jameis might not be the right quarterback for this offense.
I think that's very possible. He might be on another team next year.
Bruce Arians' offense has, when they have the right quarterback, is an excellent offense.
It's only Carson Palmer. That's the only
was
right.
Was it Kurt Warner with Bruce Arians, or was that not with, or was that Ken Whisenhunt?
I think that was Ken Whisenhunt.
So, yeah. So, anyway, we'll see. I mean, Carson Palmer's getting up there, but, like, we saw Matt Schaub throw for 400 yards this weekend. It's like, next year, Carson Palmer will be available.
What was my stat that he hadn't thrown for over 300, or no, he hadn't thrown for over 9 yards per attempt since 2012? It had been a while. So Evans and Godwin, Mike Evans and Chris Godwin, the best 1-2 receiver combo in the NFL right now. Godwin is number one in Football Outsiders DR, and Evans is 7th. Godwin has been the more reliable of these two receivers, catching 75% of his targets to 57% for Evans. But Evans is a little bit of a bigger play threat. He's coming up with 17.4 yards per reception to 15.0 for Godwin. Tight end O.J. Howard, who did not get traded before the deadline, was rumored, has been good in his limited opportunities. And that's basically it. They've been really ineffective throwing the ball to running backs besides Ronald Jones.
Can you name other wide receiver? Third receiver from the Buccaneers?
I mean, I looked it up earlier today, and no, I
can't. Adam Humphries isn't on the team anymore.
He's not walking through that door.
He's on the Titans?
No other wide receiver on the team has more than 3 receptions all season.
Wow!
So, you thought the Seahawks had limited wide receiver depth because they keep throwing it to David Moore. So once in a while when they throw it to him at the line of scrimmage,
is a fantasy dream, though.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I have Mike Evans in one league, and that's not enough Tampa Bay receivers in my life, since we're in like 8 leagues apart, piece.
Yeah,
we're in almost as many fantasy leagues as you have children.
I mean, I'm tied.
Ronald Jones has been by far the Buccaneers' most effective running backs, but hasn't really seen his usage increase over the course of the season. He's in a pretty even 3-way timeshare with veteran Peyton Barber and receiving option Dare Ogunbowale. If we turn our attention to the Tampa Bay defense, they are the number one rush defense in the NFL by a wide margin, to which Pete Carroll says, challenge accepted. They're allowing just 3.0 yards per carry and the fewest total rush yards in the NFL by 110 yards this season.
Oh, my God. Do you think that this is... I mean, the yards per carry matters. Maybe.
I mean, they're number one in DVOA.
People are definitely throwing the ball, though. Teams be throwing against the Buccaneers.
They do, because their pass defense ranks 26th by DVOA. This is kind of a little... I had to, like... investigate this one because they're middle of the pack in terms of yards per attempt against. They're 7.5, same as the Seahawks, who are also very low in
so they're bad
pass defense DVOA. No, both of these teams are worse than their pass defense DVOA looks, partially because they've both faced an easy schedule of opposing quarterbacks. The best qualifying quarterback they have faced by that Ben B metric is Jimmy Garoppolo, who ranks 11th. They also faced last week Ryan Tannehill, who ranks 7th in his small sample, taking over for Marcus Mariota.
Well, and Goff definitely threw the ball against the secondary.
He did. Not as much as he did against the Seahawks. So they also have a middling sack rate, 23rd, despite the league's second highest blitz rate at 48%, just behind the Ravens, who you recall effectively sent a lot of pressure at Russell Wilson 2 weeks ago in Seattle.
It's supposed to be a cold and clear day.
No surprise there.
Let's see some cover zero for the Bucks. Let's Todd see what Bowles, happens.
Who was the architect of many of those Arizona defenses that gave the Seahawks fits at CenturyLink Field. And they've also been called for defensive pass interference 6 times, tied for 2nd in the NFL. So I think that's part of why their DVOA is worse than their yards per attempt.
I don't think, and maybe I'll be saying something different after this game, that you can just look at these teams, look at Todd Bowles, look at Bruce Arians, and say this is a continuation of the Arizona teams that the Seahawks struggled with.
I mean, philosophically, they're doing the same thing. Strategically, they're doing the same things.
But there's still very different personnel there.
Yeah.
Not necessarily that the Cardinals had... I mean, there were some years that they had excellent teams, that they were some of the best teams in the league that they faced. But also, it's just...
But there was also, like, 2017, where they won Bruce Arians' final game to get to, I believe, 8-8 at CenturyLink Field.
Yeah, I remember. That was the game... That was Christmas Eve.
It was.
That Tyler Lockett got hurt. The Seahawks were eliminated from the playoffs.
That was a
rough one. I remember that game.
I guess I'm misremembering that, because 2000...
Seen some things.
It couldn't have been. It was New Year's Eve. It wasn't Christmas Eve. In 2017, it was the last game of the season. It was the last game Bruce Arians coached with the Cardinals. No, that definitely checks out. I guarantee you, that's true. You're just gonna keep there sitting there making faces until I look this up.
Until you say that you're wrong.
yeah. It's New Year's Eve, 26-24 loss. They were already...
What was the Christmas Eve game that we lost to the Cardinals?
Oh, there was a Christmas Eve game that they lost to the Cardinals. I'm not disputing
that. That was
the
next year.
No, it wasn't the next year. It was
the previous year.
Yeah.
Well, that game was brutal also.
Yeah, a lot of Seahawks games against the Cardinals.
Oh, you're talking about the New Year's Eve game that they lost on the missed field goal at the end of the game.
Yes.
Oh, the Seahawks season was over at that point anyway. Who cares?
But still, not going into the game, it wasn't over.
It was over throughout the game, though. By the time that field goal was missed... The season was over.
Sure. It still mattered.
Tom Cable had already punched his ticket out of town.
It was the previous year that they lost on Christmas Eve, 34-31. The year bef- before that was the game where the year before that was the Drew Stanton waving the receiver in.
I remember.
Where they won 39-32.
Good God!
Just a lot of bad games at home against Arizona. Also a 17-10 loss in 2013 that threw us off the scent before the Seahawks, fun fact, won the Super Bowl.
That was still a brutal game, though.
It was a brutal game.
I mean,
Russell Wilson went 11 of 27 for 108 yards in that game.
I don't think there were other games that they played against Todd Bowles and won easily, where he was a head coach. Like,
yeah, those games were played in Arizona, never at CenturyLink Field. They did beat them one time.
But the Jets in also. That
I guess so.
He was the head coach of them. You remember this?
Yeah, I don't count those.
It's only the Arians-Bulls combo.
I only count the 2014-19, thrilling 19-3 victory over the Cardinals at home.
I'm going to say something that I'm going to regret saying.
Yeah, you are going to regret saying it.
I have faith in Pete Carroll and Brian Schottenheimer calling the right game plan in this game. And I'll tell you what, they went into that Atlanta game with the right game plan also.
They did.
Until they ratcheted it down in the second half.
They didn't ratchet it down. They ratcheted it off. they turned it back on in the fourth quarter after Arizona got within the score.
They ratcheted off.
It sputtered back to life.
They cranked it off completely and it jerked and died. But going in, they were already up 24-0 at that point.
They were.
And in this game, I think Pete Carroll and Brian Schottenheimer are not stupid. They are aware of these numbers that you're talking about. They know that they can pass the ball against this Tampa Bay team. And provided a drop of rain does not fall or it doesn't feel gloomy at all, they are going to come out passing. And they're going to come out passing effectively.
I mean, I do think their philosophy tends to be a little different when they're playing at home than on the road, because they play much more conservatively at home. This is part of the reason they are 4-0 on the road and 2-2 at home this season.
You think it's that different, or is it just that the two best teams they've played have happened to be at home?
I mean, it's true, but they also beat the Bengals by 1 point at home.
Oh, boy.
The Bengals are looking comfortably at going 0-14 into that matchup with Miami in Week 16. With Andy Dalton. Remember when you were like, what if the Bengals are good? Remember that? I mean, I need to clip that audio. Andy Dalton, who got benched, threw for 390 yards in that
game. You remember that Christmas Eve game we were talking about?
Yeah.
When I puked activated charcoal over Luca's blanket or whatever? That's how I feel right now, thinking about that Bengals game.
Chances of victory?
75%.
Let's go 70%.
They're going to pass the ball in this game. Like, realistically, you know what's going to happen. The secondary is going to play better. This is going to be a comfortable victory.
I sure hope so.
They are a significantly better team than Tampa Bay playing at home. Okay. They're going to pick off Jameis Winston. I mean, like, how many over-under for turnovers? 2.5. What are you taking?
I'm taking the under.
You're taking the under?
Yeah.
They are going to turn over this Tampa Bay team.
That's a lot of turnovers, even for Jameis Winston. He's averaging less than 2.5 per game.
I am taking the over.
Okay.
I think they turn over Jameis a lot in this game. And for what it's worth, the defense has been fairly opportunistic this year. And
indisputably.
I'm excited about the opportunity of a remade secondary.
Okay.
If it's sunny.
Which it is forecast to be.
And if it's cloudy at all, or if it's gloomy or a drop of rain falls, they'll lose comfortably. No, I think we are overvaluing or underestimating. We know that the Saints are a very good team. And we know that Baltimore is a good team at the very least.
Yeah.
And they lost tough games to each of those teams. Are they going to give up two defensive scores or a defensive score and a special team score in this game? Do you think that is a realistic possibility?
I mean, it's a possibility, of course. It's happened 2 times in 8 games.
How dare you?
It's just math.
If that doesn't happen, they'll be able to win this game, though.
What was the fourth home game besides the Bengals and the two losses?
No one knows.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Scholars are divided on the issue. It was the Rams, of course, where they...
Yeah, that was a fun one.
That was a fun one. All right, do you have a ranking of the pumpkin beers?
Nope. Do you?
Yeah, I'm going. So I'm going. What's the Dark of the Night is my number one.
That is the cappuccino one.
No, that is not. That's the pumpkin stout.
Oh, that's the cappuccino one over there.
Yeah, the one that's called Punkuccino. That I got to say is last of mine.
Really?
I mean, I don't drink coffee. The Great Pumpkin is number two for me.
I agree with that.
The traditional classic, and then Night Owl is number three, and then Punkuccino last.
To me, the Night Owl is the worst. There's just not a lot of flavor to it.
It's a little bland. I don't dispute that.
I think the Great Pumpkin is number one. I think the Punkuccino is number two. The Dark of the Moon, and then the Night Owl.
Can I give you another take?
They also taste very similar.
I think Fields for Ferment is my number one favorite beer right now in the world.
Really?
Yeah.
Have you ever had...
so good.
The Mountain Freshest Beer?
Coors Light?
No, Rainier.
Oh.
Have you?
I've had a lot of Rainier. It's not my number one beer.
Have you ever, warm night in Austin, Texas, had a cold Lone Star?
I'm not disputing any of those things. I'm just saying, independent of those contexts, Field de Ferment is so good. It always delivers. Every single time.
I'm trying to think of what another competitor...
Like a legit competitor?
I have such a preference for light beers right now.
It's a pale ale. It's not that heavy. It's drinkable. Part of what makes Field de Ferment so great.
It's hoppy, though.
It's appropriately hoppy. It's a good beer.
Have you ever had a real cold Tecate with lime in it?
Oh, no. I feel like that's a sign that we need to go.
Has it ever been almost Halloween and you had a whole oof of pumpkin beers?
It has, and it wasn't as good as the Field de Ferment I heard earlier this evening, with all due respect to Elysian's Great Pumpkin beers.
Well, on that note, have an excellent Halloween night.
Yeah.
And thanks for listening.
Thanks.